This is the Sunshine Edition, Session 2014, a WLRN special examining the Florida State Legislature in its final week, its final day today of scheduled work. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. So we just have hours left in the lawmaking session in Tallahassee. Lots of work still to be done, including the state budget, and late word out of the capital city about a possible deal on gaming revenues between the state and the Seminole Tribe. We'll have details of that coming up. Some high hopes into this legislative session regarding child welfare reform. Have those hopes been fulfilled? Plus undocumented students, guns, and medical marijuana. Join the conversation on Twitter at WLRN. Use the hashtag Sunshine Edition. All that to come in the next hour. This is the Sunshine Edition, Session 2014. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. No late-night drama, no early morning protests, no real threats of a special session. If the Florida legislative session this year was reality TV, it wouldn't really last long. There was very little public clashing, provoking political clashes previous sessions have played witness to. If Florida lawmakers over the past 2 months haven't been exactly harmonious, they have been generally singing in tune with one another. One reason may be that the state is flush with money. For the first time in 6 years, the state has a budget surplus instead of a deficit. Lawmakers were not forced into kind of a Lord of the Flies scenario, fighting it out with one another over spending programs and pet projects. WLRN's Gina Jordan takes us through the halls of the Capitol during these final hours of session.
As the legislative session winds down, it's been a pretty tame 2 months in Tallahassee. The Capitol courtyard is a good example. This is an open, brick-lined space outside between the Capitol and other government buildings. And this is a place where many news conferences and rallies usually happen. But the courtyard hasn't seen a ton of action, especially this week because of the weather. There's been several straight days of heavy rain up here. Everything is soaking wet, and there are flooding concerns in some areas. But the usual crowd is in place on the fourth floor of the Capitol. The fourth floor rotunda is the area between the entrances to the Senate and the House chambers. So we see lots of people in suits here. Lobbyists and lawyers are standing around with folders and briefcases. Lots of media here. We have some people huddled near big screen TVs showing the floor debate in each chamber. One of these folks is getting his shoes shined in a chair near the Senate entrance. We also see groups who support causes, like students wearing caps and gowns, holding signs supporting in-state tuition for the children of illegal immigrants. Sometimes a senator or a representative will come into the rotunda to chat with someone, then go back into chambers. That's all normal. Now, several years ago, Governor Rick Scott's first session was rife with Awake the State rallies. Lots of protests and rallies on both sides. But having a budget surplus has lessened all of that. And then also the subject matter that has been so controversial in sessions past hasn't brought the same kind of outcry this year. We've had bills to further loosen gun restrictions and tighten restrictions on abortion. We've had calls to revisit the Stand Your Ground law that was implicated in the death of Trayvon Martin. And it may just be that people are all protested out. Maybe they're even numb to a certain extent after some of these bills have been brought up year after year in the legislature with lawmakers trying to put them through. There does seem to be a general consensus that this year's session was largely benign, and that was the plan. This is an election year, and none of these politicians want their name or their party associated with controversy. The bills that some might consider controversial actually accommodate the Republican Party base. Republicans control the legislature, and they know that certain topics, like fewer gun restrictions, will make their constituents happy ahead of Election Day. So the chambers will continue taking up bills and passing them until they vote on the budget. They're in a required 72-hour waiting period right now. They can't take a final vote on the budget until around 8:30 tonight. Then they'll have what's known as sine die, where lawmakers stream into the fourth floor rotunda alongside members of the public. The leaders will drop a white handkerchief to much applause, signifying the end of the 2014 session. I'm Gina Jordan in Tallahassee.
Waiting for the white handkerchief to fall later tonight in the state capitol in Tallahassee. Sergio Bustos is political editor with the Miami Herald. Amy Hollyfield, assistant managing editor of politics with the Tampa Bay Times, both joining us here on the Sunshine Edition. A benign session, Sergio, because possibly of this election cycle that we're just about to really launch into here in Florida, but also fairly harmonious, even on some traditionally divisive social issues.
Good morning, Tom, Amy. I think what happens is, the governor has a bully pulpit and he is the one that can drive the agenda. And frankly, as you heard, he really didn't have a very aggressive agenda, and he, and that's why it, yeah. it's not as cantankerous as it could be.
Amy, Governor Scott's agenda can essentially be counted up with $500 million in tax cuts. That's really what he was pushing for 75 days ago ahead of this agenda, and he got it within the first couple of weeks, essentially.
Good morning. Yes, exactly. That happened really quick. But he picked up some other priorities as the session went on. He got behind the immigrant tuition, the effort to get in-state tuition for immigrant students, and helped push that through, people will say. But yeah, he had a very modest agenda, and lawmakers made sure it happened quick.
Yeah, and it happened quick. Does it give him the firepower that he needs politically, not financially? We know the firepower is there financially for the governor, but what about politically?
I would say, I'm not sure how much he's going to milk it. He's going to use it. He already is.
Yeah.
He's you know, it's your money tax cut tour. He's using it hard to fight Charlie Crist, the likely Democratic opponent. And using it to say, look, Charlie Crist started this mess. I cleaned it up. Don't you want to give me another term?
On the social issues, Sergio, any surprises there in terms of the real lack of conflict, the lack of drama on guns here a year after George Zimmerman and Stand Your Ground, medical marijuana with the Amendment 2 pending in November, same-sex marriage and the lawsuit making its way through the courts?
You know, I've always said in Florida, a politician has to literally speak through both sides of their mouth, in English and Spanish. And he's got the ability to do that with this immigrant tuition bill that Amy mm-hmm. just mentioned. And then you just mentioned a host of issues that he can tell another part of Florida that he's doing. So he's going to have plenty to put in campaign ads. And on the stump when he goes to campaign for re-election.
Another issue that he has been trying to clear off the agenda is the gaming compact with the Seminole Tribe in the state of Florida that's been responsible for hundreds of millions of dollars in state revenue over the past several years. We've got late word from the Capitol that the governor has reached a deal with the Seminoles that would allow the tribe more gambling offerings in return for a substantial boost in payments that goes into the state coffers every year. We don't have any details at this point, and of course, any deal would have to be presented and ratified by the state legislature. But Democrats are telling us they're not at the negotiating table, and if they're not there, they won't vote for any gambling agreement with the tribe. Democratic State Representative Jim Waldman of Coconut Creek says the governor will have to decide between the Seminole revenue and the resort casinos that the contention is the Republican caucus supports.
If they don't want to do it, that's fine. But if you grant exclusivity or continue exclusivity to the Seminoles, you have destroyed and ended that conversation. And I think the state would be making a tremendous mistake by ending the conversation.
Gaming is usually a very divisive issue. And Amy, this time it really was taken out of the agenda relatively quickly. Why is the governor so focused on this compact if it still has about a year or so left on it?
It can be an election issue for him. It's certainly, there's money for the state that's at stake. He's trying to show leadership. It's something that people think, again, it's something else he can tie to Charlie Crist, who did the last negotiation of the gaming compact. Another way to say, look, I did this better. And certainly, you know, he's going to have a tough road here because it's not just Democrats who are upset they weren't at the negotiating table. It's leadership who's already said, look, we don't really want to come back for a special session since you didn't get us involved.
Yeah, the only talk, Sergio, this time around about the possibility of a special session has been around gaming, and very quickly Senate leadership put an end to that talk.
Yeah, you know, a governor has to bring people to the table, and this is a very large table to accommodate people. And I think, as Amy points out, he's already kind of politically offended some.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the fact of the matter is there are a lot of egos in Tallahassee, and you have to know how to massage those egos in a way that they don't get really ticked off.
Yeah.
And this is one of those that could blow up on him, because if the negotiations don't go right, you know, this could become a huge campaign issue for Crist. He could turn around the table and say, hey, I negotiated this the right way.
Yeah, if leadership doesn't feel that they've got skin in the game, pun intended, they may not come along to get along.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Well, a budget document is a expression of priorities, certainly. And the gaming money has been very important to Florida through the tough years of the Great Recession. Sergio, what do you think this $75 billion state budget that the lawmakers are likely to pass late tonight with $11 billion in public education for elementary and secondary schools, what does it say about state priorities?
there's been a lot of political talk about how much money truly is going to education, given that Scott had cut before. And by the way, as we're speaking, the budget had grown to $77.1 billion.
Here, billion there. And
as
Senator
you put
Dixon,
it at the top, you know, when there's a lot of money sloshing around up there, there's plenty of people that are more than willing to negotiate and talk about things. But I don't think the average person or Floridian is going to look at the number. I think you're going to see specific actions. And if the schools, if they see more money for schools and they see that things are improving, that's going to go a long way, at least in the perception of Floridian, that things are getting better.
Certainly this budget includes that tax cut that Governor Scott is going to run on, which of course is the vehicle registration, lower fees. Amy Hollyfield with the Tampa Bay Times, your assessment of this budget document, $77 billion and counting here in the final hours, as an expression of priorities in Florida.
I think Sergio had it right. They went for education, they went for tax breaks, and certainly they've used that surplus to sprinkle some money in their hometown districts because it is an election year, and people need to know that they're being looked out for by their lawmakers. In our paper today, we splashed across our front page all the money that's coming to the Tampa Bay area for projects across all the counties, and it's pretty remarkable.
Education obviously is key in this budget. The other significant education issue, which we've mentioned, is this undocumented students' ability to pay in-state tuition at Florida colleges and universities. Myra Rubio was an undocumented immigrant working on her family's farm in South Dade County in Homestead. She now has deferred action. She attends Miami-Dade College. She says this bill, if approved, signed into law, allowing undocumented students to pay in-state tuition, would make a big difference for undocumented families.
Many of our families are low-income families, which is like poverty level, and they don't make the sufficient amount of money that we need to get our kids through college, like my family.
This is a significant turnaround, Sergio, in terms of Tallahassee's embracement of undocumented students and the plight of the undocumented here in Florida, isn't it?
Oh, certainly. I mean, if you look at the past, both Governor Scott and former Governor Charlie Crist were opposed to this.
Right.
In fact, PolitiFact Florida pointed this out and outlined all the times they have opposed it. It's been a complete turnaround. It's a real symbolic issue politically. Look, it affects about 1,300 people annually, according to the tracking on it.
That's the number of students that now could qualify.
That could be eligible.
Yeah, because I think you have to be in high school for 3 years in Florida.
Yeah, there's certain
stipulations under the legislation.
But you know, for a family, as the young woman mentioned, it's nearly $15,000 a year that they could be saving. But again, symbolic issue. I'm sure Crist and Governor Scott are going to find ways to exploit it. Expect to see this one on TV ads, again, in Spanish. Not so much in English.
Yeah. I do have to bring up the issue of guns here, Amy. Florida has been long known as a state friendly to gun owners. This session, lawmakers proposed allowing Floridians to carry a concealed weapon during times of emergency, like hurricanes, emergency evacuations, even civil unrest. And as amended late this week by one Democrat lawmaker from Miami during a zombie apocalypse. Yes, that was included in an amendment that would allow for unpermitted concealed weapon carry. It failed in the Senate. Will it come back in another session, do you think?
It could definitely come back in another session. It was pretty remarkable what happened yesterday in the Senate, though. It was a Republican from Clearwater, Jack Latvella, who put an amendment on it, and the sponsor pulled it because he hated what it did to it. It's pretty remarkable. You don't see many gun bills die in the legislature.
And it didn't die because of the zombie apocalypse,
it
necessarily.
Did not.
Yeah, so specify.
It was a different amendment. This amendment, one of the questions about this bill was that it was pretty ambiguous.
Right.
You know, you could carry a gun in time of emergency. Well, how long and where? So the amendment was putting some parameters on it. It was saying you could only carry it for 24 hours and only until you reached your evacuation destination. Well, the sponsor hated that. The amendment actually, you know, it went on a voice vote and they actually did a board vote on it. So we can see how everyone voted on that amendment, which doesn't happen all the time on those things.
Amy Hollyfield, Assistant Managing Editor of Politics for the Tampa Bay Times. Sergio Bustos, Politics Editor at the Miami Herald. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Sunshine Edition. Still to come on our program, after the Miami Herald investigation into the deaths of kids who had had contact with the Child Protective Agency, will the legislature act? This is the Sunshine Edition on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson, session 2014. Thanks again for listening. Perhaps one of the most anticipated legislative responses this session was in regards to the Department of Children and Families. Calls for reforms had been heard as early as last summer, and the volume increased after the Miami Herald investigation, Innocence Lost, appeared. The Herald documented the verified deaths of 477 children by abuse or neglect in Florida, kids who had had contact with the Child Welfare Agency. Live with us is Mary Ellen Kloss, covering the legislature for the Miami Herald. Mary Ellen, what's the latest on the reform legislative effort?
Well, the bill is ready to go and be voted on by the House. It got snagged in some last-minute maneuvering on other bills, and they didn't take it up yesterday. But there are no amendments on it, so it's expected to be passed today by the House and go to the governor.
So this is a clean bill, so-called clean bill. What are some of the provisions in it?
Well, the most significant is it now changes the language to require that the health and safety of children shall be, quote, paramount concern. And believe it or not, that hasn't been the language that they have used in the past. They actually had, you know, other definitions. And because of this, they are now going to change the way the agency is, the standards by which they follow for keeping children safe. When an investigator finds that a child's in a vulnerable situation and decides to leave the child there, the burden is now heavier for the agency to be sure that they check up and make sure that the parents are doing the right thing.
Yeah,
arguably, or they remove the child.
Arguably, Mary Ellen, this is in response to some of the findings, Sergio, of your paper's investigation into the 477 verified deaths of children by abuse and neglect in the past 6 years. Pointed to among the concerns was this philosophy in the agency of family preservation, of trying to keep a family together. Now, codified in this bill is the health and safety being paramount. Does that answer that criticism?
I think it does, but it's going to be a kind of watch and see how this unfolds. Will the money be effective? We'll certainly be keeping monitoring it and keeping an eye on it. But whether or not, and this is always very interesting when it comes to legislation. I think lawmakers and us in the media too want to see positive change. Mm-hmm. We want to see, you know, things get better. But sometimes, you know, you don't really see it until it actually goes into practice. And I think we're just going to have to keep an eye on it.
Mary Ellen, I know that there had been some reform talk regarding education requirements for case investigators for DCF. Is that included in this bill?
Yes, they've changed it a little bit. They now are going to require by 2019 to have 50% of the workforce that do all these investigations have a social work degree or another higher level degree. And the idea here was to kind of professionalize the workforce so that they have people who can better assess, you know, the situation when they go into these at-risk homes. But the thing that the advocates are very happy about, though, is that it actually enshrines into law that they use critical thinking skills when they go in and look at these families, which is kind of interesting that they're actually putting it into law that people have to be smart.
There's also been calls for more transparency on the part of the DCF regarding the child welfare investigators and the death investigations even. And of course, at a WLRN Miami Herald town hall regarding Innocence Lost, we put that to Deputy Secretary of the agency, Pete DeGree, in terms of transparency.
Were you shocked by the results?
No, not at all, because we had we've done similar studies. We had the analytic group SAS come in and do a very, very comprehensive review, and frankly, their data ties just about perfectly to the Herald's data.
The agency was not surprised by the results of the Innocence Lost investigation, Sergio. Are you satisfied that the transparency is going to be more forthcoming?
Well, we haven't been very satisfied at this point. it's been a real a struggle to get information from DCF. And we just hope, looking ahead, they'll see the larger good here and be as transparent as possible, not just to the media, you know, allow the public to really, you know, help them out and see where the situation can be improved. But I wouldn't give them a very strong grade on transparency.
Amy Hollifield with the Tampa Bay Times, the new designate secretary, the interim secretary, as of this coming Monday, comes from your neck of the woods. Mike Carroll headed up the region that includes Tampa Bay. What are your thoughts on transparency as Mike Carroll moves into the interim secretary top job? Amy Hollifield, you still with us? We've lost Tampa Bay here. Mary Ellen, there has been some efforts to codify more transparency in terms of website releases and other kind of electronic releases for data for the agency. Is that included in this bill as well?
Yes, it requires that the agency post on its website the fact that any child that dies and the cause of death for children under age 5, and our reporting has found that that is, you know, over and above the majority of child deaths.
Marilyn Kloss, we'll let you go. I know it's a busy time for you in the capital city in Tallahassee, covering the final day of the legislature for the Miami Herald. Back to Tampa Bay. Amy Hollifield, I think you're back with us. Mike Carroll, the new interim secretary as of Monday for the agency, comes from your neck of the woods. What are your thoughts on his track record of transparency?
I can't talk specifically to his track record of transparency, but I will say people locally had very good things to say about him. People were excited that he was chosen to be the interim, and he's not the permanent. He still has to get through the governor's reelection. But there's some optimism for what will happen under his leadership.
Mike Carroll had been heading up the Tampa Bay branch of the Department of Children and Families for several years, named as interim secretary for that agency beginning this coming Monday. When we spoke with him earlier this week here on the Sunshine Edition, he said judge the agency on what happens, not what has happened.
Much of what we do now is how we're interacting with families and going forward. And so I think the litmus test now is to be looking at those cases that we have open active investigations, open active service cases, and then going out from a point in time to see how these improvements are impacting services and what type of outcomes we're getting, quite frankly.
Sergio Bustos, political editor for the Miami Herald. Is that the proper metric to judge the interim secretary in the days, weeks, and months to come?
Well, we've kind of judged the past. It is time to look at the future. But as I said earlier, again, I think the legislation's pretty comprehensive. Whether it does the job remains to be seen.
Your paper wrote in a real strongly worded opinion, quote, DCF is basically hiding the true number of children who have died at the hands of abusive or neglectful caretakers. It's an insidious and incredibly official policy that should end immediately. Sergio, do you have hopes that this legislation will end that?
I think that's the belief. Again, whether it comes through, this is one of those topics that's very difficult to deal with, because you're talking about the lives of, you know, as we mentioned with the series Innocence Lost, very young children. I think no one is opposed to trying to improve things. But it certainly would help if the state agency would be as transparent as possible, because only through kind of that sunshine can we kind of see maybe to improve places where it needs to be improved and add more money where money needs to be added.
Amy Hollifield with the Tampa Bay Times, the governor talked about $40 million, with a chunk of that being earmarked for child investigators. There is some concern, though, that investigators are only part of the solution, that without more money for community-based organizations to help provide the drug abuse treatment, mental health services, domestic violence services, that more investigators may not necessarily beget safer children.
Definitely. This is going to be an ongoing conversation because of the good work of the Miami Herald. This legislation is significant. It'll be interesting to see how it gets implemented. There's money put toward this. And I guarantee you this is going to continue to be a topic among the state.
Absolutely. Lots of folks that are watching that carefully. Also watching carefully the debate here in Florida over drug use, legally sanctioned drug use, in this case, medical marijuana. In the particular case of the Florida State Legislature, this session, it is a very highly limited strain of medical marijuana that's been the topic of debate. Steve Bosquet with the Tampa Bay Times with us from the capital city in Tallahassee. What's the latest on the Charlotte's Web medical marijuana bill here in the final waning hour, Steve?
Well, it has to go through one last pass in the Florida Senate, which won't be an issue. It'll happen. I mean, it's definitely going to pass. And last night we had the somewhat surprising news that Governor Rick Scott enthusiastically said he would sign it. But and that's partly because this bill was worked very, very strategically and very well by the sponsors, namely a young man from the Panhandle, Representative Matt Gaetz, a conservative Republican, very pro-law enforcement kind of guy, who took the lead on this bill, along with a young Democrat from South Florida, Representative Katie Edwards.
Yeah.
And the vote last night was astonishing to a lot of people, 111-7 on this bill.
Incredible support, Steve. We had been hearing talk earlier this week that there were some efforts to expand the diseases that that this strain of medical marijuana could be used for. What were the relative success or failure of some of the efforts to expand it?
It was expanded to cover some other maladies like muscle spasms, ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, and some other chronic conditions. I don't have the whole list before
sure.
me, but they did that. They also, my colleague Mary Ellen Foss reported how it appears that they've amended the bill also in a way that favors Florida farmers who grow this strain of marijuana, the cannabis.
Actually talking about the cultivation now of it, not just the prescription of it.
Yeah, that's right. So, and you know, who are we talking about? We're talking about, for the most part, kids who have severe epileptic seizures. And so, and the advocates did a great job of explaining their situation and so forth. And so, you know, the point I'm making is the proponents here have the great weight on their side of being able to say we're trying to help kids.
Amy Hollyfield, politics editor at Tampa Bay Times, the kind of support that this limited medical marijuana piece of legislation has received in the Florida House, how shocked are you?
I think it's a little surprising to people. I mean, this is a very conservative legislature.
Right.
You know, again, as Steve said, you know, you had a conservative lawmaker who brought this to the table, who fought hard for it. You had families who had a constant presence around the halls with their children, showing their story, showing what this meant to them. And you could see what difference this legislation could make in the lives of these children and their families.
Sergio, it's a real lesson in lawmaking to some degree as well. If you want to take the hot political button issue of medical marijuana out of it, just thinking of this as the process, Representative Gaetz, a young Republican, obviously with a political family, his father is the president of the Florida Senate, told us a story here on Sunshine Edition earlier this week that it was at the dinner table with his parents that he discussed this issue. And when mom was on his side, dad came along.
You know, I think what's fascinating about this issue is that the public in general and the media as well, We have in this Twitter age, this 24-hour news cycle that's reduced to a few seconds.
It's a news stream now,
yeah,
not a cycle,
stream,
but a stream.
Streaming. But we have a view of our lawmakers, I think, as kind of these folks that are not reactive to public pressure or the things that happen. And I think what's happened with this bill, I remember Mary Ellen had written a piece about one of the families here in Broward, and it was very emotional, you know, very, you know, really tugged at your emotions as to what was happening to these families, having to leave Florida to travel to Colorado. I know it's been featured in other places, but this kind of legislation just shows that lawmakers are listening.
Mm-hmm.
They are listening. And if the public brings enough pressure, there is possibility of change. So it is refreshing.
Steve Bosquet, Tampa Bay Times in Tallahassee, covering the final votes on this medical marijuana Charlotte's Web bill. You mentioned that an amendment that's been included may help favor Florida growers. Some concern earlier this week that this bill would create the infrastructure for the future expansion for the use of medical marijuana. Seems like that could be a possibility.
Yeah, I think so. We'll have to see. I think that, you know, the much broader, of course, issue regarding medical marijuana is the amendment that's on the November ballot, which I would think what's happened here in the last few days is going to definitely increase the chances that amendment passes. Conservative legislators have sanctioned, you know, the use of medical marijuana in very limited circumstances, and that's a very important step in this debate.
It is an important step, Steve, but those who raised concern with the amendment to raise specific concern with what one legislator called loosey-goosey language of the amendment to really allowing doctors potentially to prescribe medical marijuana for a teenager who's experiencing anxiety over a SAT test coming up.
Right. I know. We have a long history of unintended consequences with the Florida legislature. What they do and what they intend to do is not always the way things happen in reality.
Yeah. Now,
it's going to take time to know the answer to that.
Absolutely. Amy Hollyfield, assistant managing editor at the Tampa Bay Times. Let's talk about the politics of marijuana. Steve Buscale, we'll let you go because I know you got a busy agenda in front of you as well. But Amy, let's talk about the politics of this. Steve brings up Amendment 2, which of course will be on the November ballot, along with the governor's race, along with Florida House races, along with some Florida Senate races. How does the Florida legislature endorsement of limited medical marijuana potentially impact turnout and the demographics of voters come November?
I'll take the opposite side
All
here.
Right.
I'm not sure that it has a direct, I think that medical marijuana being on the November ballot was already a big deal. I'm not sure the endorsement of the limited strain of medical marijuana for children is going to make a dramatic impact on what was already going to happen. It's going to be interesting. It's going to add to the conversation. But the amendment in November is a much broader conversation. And certainly as other states are having these things happen. And in a year when you have Charlie Crist coming back to the ballot for governor, his boss, John Morgan, who's the face of the pro medical marijuana
right.
effort,
an attorney in Central Florida.
Exactly. There's a lot of dynamics here that are going to make it interesting.
Sergio, talk to the point though about Republicans now in the Panhandle, for instance, presumably who have voted for this medical marijuana. How does that impact kind of their election campaigns and the potential makeup of session 2015?
Well, I think if they pitch this right, that this wasn't about politics, it was personal.
Yeah.
And when they hear the stories of these individual families and their suffering and their struggle to find something to help treat their kids, it's not as if this is a cure. I mean, basically, it's something to help them.
Treating the symptoms.
Yeah. I think once you get that message across, I think it'll be understood. But I tend to agree with Amy on this, that I think it's going to get lost in other bigger issues this election.
Yeah.
Mainly, I think the immigrant tuition bill might be one that might draw some more eyebrows around the state, and along with just the fact that you have two, you know, a former governor and a governor running who used to be all part of the same party.
We have two governors running for governor, as a matter of
yes,
fact. Yes,
not to mention, you know, I think people are going to have a lot of television ads that are going to be going through because of all the money.
Yeah, the sense is there is going to be a very expensive campaign. Sergio Bustos, covering politics, is editor at the Miami Herald. Amy Hollyfield, assistant managing editor of politics at the Tampa Bay Times. Thank you, both of you, for joining us. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Sunshine Edition. And still to come on the program, politics as the family profession in South Florida. We're back on the Sunshine Edition here, session 2014. I'm Tom Hudson on WLRN. Thanks again for listening. Politics is a way of life, certainly. It can also be a family profession. WLRN Miami Herald News. We've got a new blog called What's the Story? And we let your curiosity hear about our unique slice of real estate here in South Florida guide some of our reporting. WLRN senior producer Elaine Chen is along with us here. Good morning, Elaine.
Good morning, Tom.
Tell us about some of the questions you've gotten from the audience that they're curious about.
We've gotten a lot of great questions about South Florida history, maybe curious landmarks. One of the questions that we've received, although it didn't get enough votes, but an interesting question we got was about the Moorish architecture of Opa-locka City yeah. Hall, why we don't have more solar panels in South Florida, and then we we've also gotten some more serious questions, too. One that Wilson Sarah is working on is how do low-income parents, particularly single parents, make it in South Florida?
You mentioned voting. What we do is we put up some questions on the blog, What's the Story, and have the audience vote on which question we should kind of go after. And one of those questions was in regards to the family business of politics.
Yeah, we received a question, an interesting one, from Jacqueline Marvin from Aventura, who wanted to know how many current South Florida elected officials are related to other South Florida elected officials.
Have you been able to find the answer?
I think instead of looking for a number, what I've been starting out with is by looking at what are some of the benefits of being a related elected official, and what it says about South Florida and the health of our political system. So to start out, I spoke to two South Florida elected officials who are in the unusual position of being in office while they're, in this case, while their dads are in office, and that is Miami City Commissioner Francis Suarez and Miami-Dade School Board member Raquel Regalado. When I spoke to Francis Suarez, he talked about being the son of the mayor while he was going through adolescence.
Everything that I did was under a microscope. If I misbehaved, you know, you couldn't hide anywhere. It's far more difficult than I think people realize, and that we probably even feel comfortable saying.
And I think particularly for Francis Suarez, I mean, he was 8 when his dad went into office, and yeah. I think when his dad left at least the mayor's seat, he was 16. That's already a really hard time to go through without having always the public eye on you.
And of course, at one point, he was running for mayor as well.
Right, yeah. And that's something that he kept in mind, I think, and that's maybe, you know, part of what informed his decision to then drop out when mm-hmm. his wife was pregnant. The other person that I spoke to was the Miami-Dade school board member, Raquel Regalado, who is the daughter of Miami City Mayor Tomas Regalado. She became Mayor Regalado's chief of staff at age 21, and here she is describing the first moment that she realized the attention was a little different for chief of staff and the daughter of a mayor.
It was a Joan Fleshman column that was written about someone that I was dating. I love Joan Fleshman, but I'm glad that she's retired. But yeah, the first time I opened the paper and I saw my name and who I was dating, I thought, wow, it's a little different now.
And she did add that it didn't work out with the person who was in that column. But she said when she first opened it up, it was different. She always felt that she was in the public eye because her parents were journalists. But once her dad was in politics, and then especially when he became mayor, the attention was at a whole nother level.
Clearly, being an adolescent and you know, having your private life perhaps be open for the public because of what your parent does is a liability for the adolescent. There's clearly benefits, though.
Right. I mean, because with that attention, I mean, your name is in the news all the time, and part of campaigning, I mean, the biggest expense is just trying to get voters to just know your name, which they both admit, you know, they didn't have to go through that because their names are already well known. I mean, Francis Suarez said that of course he's not trying to say that means that they're the most qualified, but you know, because elections, they're not always fair, they're not always rational, and the best person doesn't always win. Yeah. But it's the best system that we have. Voters often choose who they want to vote for just based on who they like, and who they like is often just based on who they're familiar with.
Yeah. Listen, we know we've got a curious crew out there. How do you submit a question for What's the Story if interested?
So you can go to our website, WLRN.org, and under the special coverage tab, you can select What's the Story, and it'll take you to our page where you can submit a question.
And we'll go out and find what the story is here on WLRN. Elaine Chen joining us. Thank you, Elaine. Still to come on the Sunshine Edition, the future of highway travel is today, right now, on I-95 in Miami-Dade County. It's the Sunshine Edition, session 2014 here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. For the past 4 months, WLRN's Kenny Malone has been documenting life on one of the most loathed, stress-inducing, but also essential pieces of infrastructure here in South Florida, I-95. It's our End of the Road series, and it's touched on everything from hate songs inspired by I-95 to the ever-changing tolls on the 95 express lanes, which Kenny recently looked at through Kevin Serino's commute home from Miami to Lauderhill.
He throws his bag in a blue Chevy Cobalt he calls the Millennium Falcon and drives to his 95 on-ramp, where an express lane sign will tell Kevin Serino his fate.
Yeah, under $5. If it's over $5, it's a bad, bad sign.
Not bad because it's expensive, Bad because Kevin has learned what that big number really means.
That day you pay $7, we're trying to get you not to go there.
And the way to get you not to go there, says Rory Santana, is to charge more. Santana's overseen the 95 Express since it opened in 2008. He explains the system like this. In order to keep traffic flowing in the express lanes, only so many cars can be let in. As the price goes up, the number of cars in those lanes should go down. It's like auctioning off those precious rush hour spots to the highest bidders. Over the last several months, record numbers of drivers have been willing to shell out $7, which has created a problem for Santana.
If it's $7 and everybody piles in, we lost that opportunity to try and keep the spaces between the vehicles there and keep the speed up and keep the flow going. So now it's going to break down. And if it breaks down, the general purpose lanes breaks down.
Kenny Malone joins us now. Obviously, Kenny, those I-95 drivers hearing that might notice the ride in the fast lane is no longer capped at 7. It can be in the double digits now.
It's in the double digits. The max right now is 10.50. That went into effect starting March 1st, and the idea was that $7, too many people were paying it.
Right.
Officials thought that maybe slowly over time we'd hit 8, 9, and then 10.50 would be a good cap. Within 2 days of the new max being capable, 10.50 was hit.
Is that right?
That's right. So there's all of the new express lanes, which we'll talk about in a second. Those won't have caps. This is a capped because it was the experiment, and
right. You
know, it's just it sort of feels better to know that it's not going to go too high. But within the rule that allowed the initial increase to 10.50, there's a contingency that says if for 45 days within a 180-day stretch, mm-hmm. the maximum is hit, the toll will go up again. And so we're getting to this point where we've hit 10.50 a bunch of times. And so I spoke to Rory Santana, who you heard in that clip, about this, and he said, well, we have hit it 13 times so far this year.
Yep.
That being said, March and April are the peak seasons
sure.
for drivers. So he does not think that we're going to be seeing those max instances to the level where we're going to see another increase.
This is part of that dynamic tolling idea, the market-based economy. The more, the higher the demand, supply is limited, so the higher the price essentially goes up, right?
That's the idea. And, yeah. and what they'll tell you is, what officials will tell you is, we don't set the price, you set the price. So it's on you, South Florida drivers.
Yeah. This is the future of driving.
Absolutely. If there's one thing that you're going to be seeing loads of in the next 5-6 years, it is more and more of these express lanes. A project scheduled to be completed in about 2017 will take express lanes from the Palmetto just south of the Dolphin
yep.
all the way up to 595. As you've seen, 595 Express is currently working.
Yep.
So what you have is this essentially this NASCAR loop of express lanes. You're not supposed to speed,
right,
but clear traffic.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, part of the End of the Road series also is collecting all of those individual stories and those folks that are staring at brake lights, looking at the road in front of them. And you've got a sneak peek of the story for next week.
We do. So just to set this up quickly, it turns out that for this couple, Neil and Alice Roberts, and Alice, by the way, runs the Downtown Development Authority. You may have heard her. And one of their go-to party stories happened about 25 years ago, merging onto I-95.
I remember my husband and I were having a fight, as a matter of fact. We were running late to this wedding.
Or at least according to Alice, we were running late. I don't know. I don't remember why we were late, but I know I was getting the blame for being late.
So I was like, we need to get there.
The wedding is at 3:00. We're not going to get there on time.
I'd hate to arrive late.
We're going to miss the beginning of the wedding. We're going to have to sit at the back of the church.
He's saying, well, you know, we can't always be on time on these things, you know.
Just on and on and on, you know, one thing after another like that.
Neil is driving quickly. He pulls onto 195, headed to merge onto I-95.
And I'm probably not paying as close attention as I should because I'm getting chewed out for being late. And after I pulled on this, I get this loud horn honk. I think I probably cut this guy off.
I don't think we did.
And that's when he comes roaring up alongside us.
So it was on my side of the car, and he pulled alongside of there.
And I think Alice said something that made me look at him.
I said, oh my God, he's got a gun.
And I look over past her. She's to my right.
I ducked.
And I see this gun
pointed at us.
And first thought in my mind was, holy what the hey?
What the hey indeed. We'll hear the conclusion of that story Monday on End of the Road. Kenny, now that you've been reporting on I-95, curious, do you use it more or less?
I mean, I think by the nature of reporting on it, I'm simply on it more. I mean, I will say this morning I was in the car when you teased the future of I-95 is today coming up on Sunshine Edition. I was on 95 when I heard that
tease. At the time, yeah.
So, yeah, I'm out there. So, you know, look out your passenger window and maybe I'll be slowly puttering along in the right lane.
You may find Kenny with a microphone. Kenny Malone, reporter here at WLRN Miami Herald. The Sunshine Edition is produced by Elaine Chen in the WLRN Miami Herald newsroom. Jessica Mazzaros provided additional production support. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Our editorial director is Alicia Zuckerman. WLRN's program director is Peter Mertz. Sound direction all this week by Paul Leary, and our theme music by Aaron Libos. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.